speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
May the turbulence of our age yield to the true time of peace, when men and nations shall share a life that honors the dignity of each, the brotherhood of all.
I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open mind.
Hello and welcome to the Republic, a show dedicated to history, civics, and U.S. institutions. I'm Jake, and I am no longer alone on this episode. Matt is back.
Woo.
Matt, how have you been?
I've been good. Just social distancing, like us all surviving the heat wave, the heat apocalypse that was upon us this week.
Gosh, did you walk around with your mask on?
No. I didn't go out anywhere. I was in my house.
Yeah, it was hot out there,
man. It was too hot to be anywhere.
Yeah, so we're recording, for context, we're recording this on Tuesday, and this will air Thursday of the first, basically the first of July. So the... everybody living in the Portland metro area experienced essentially the furnace that dropped on our area.
Yeah.
In my life, I never thought I would experience that kind of heat in this area.
Yeah. I think the closest that we ever got might have been when I was in like middle school. It was like 108.
Mm-hmm.
But to be like almost pushing 115. I think we hit 115.
Yeah, here we did.
It was unfortunate for everyone.
It was terrible, and I hope everybody made it through okay.
Yeah,
because that was quite the experience. It's nuts when 90 feels cool.
Yeah, that's a horrible reality to live in.
Yeah, and somehow people still think global warming and climate change isn't a thing, but that is not the topic of this month's episode. We are going to talk about something much more fun: the Senate filibuster.
Yeah,
amongst other things. So I want to just. I'm so glad you're back, because let me tell you one thing, doing this by myself is not fun. It is a lot of talking, and honestly, none of our listeners like listening to me only for an entire hour. That's a lot of Jake droning. So I'm so glad you're back. And so we're going to talk a bit about basically asking the question, is our system democratic? And that's kind of, I don't know, I feel like I'm being kind of Tucker Carlson right there, right? It's just with that kind of high-pitched question mark at the end. But we're going to examine the Senate filibuster, equal representation in the Senate, and then also the Electoral College, and talking about what were the ideas behind some of these things. Because one, equal representation and the Electoral College were both things that have been in our history for a long time. Yeah. The only one of these three things that is actually enshrined in the Constitution is the one state, two senators.
Yeah.
Equal representation as part of the Virginia Compromise. The Electoral College came shortly after the ratification of the Constitution. And the Senate filibuster, as we'll talk, has formed itself over time. It started with Aaron Burr in 1806, kind of just doing some housekeeping on Senate rules, and it's manifested into this tool that gets talked about almost everywhere every day on the Hill. Mm-hmm. So whether it should be gone or not. So that's going to be kind of our topic of conversation for today. And with that said, let's get into our topic. So like I said, we're going to talk about a few of the institutional mechanisms that give minority party is not the party that's not currently in power, but the minority party in terms of votes received.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Party for a long time has been the party that receives far less votes than the Democrats. They haven't won an actual, there's been one time, I think, since Reagan or since Bush Sr. that the Republicans have won more votes in a presidential election than their Democratic challengers, yet they've won multiple presidencies.
Yeah.
So there's these institutionalized mechanisms that help promote the minority party in terms of having agency within the system, which is very unique for any sort of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at a lot of the European parliaments and presidential systems, and it's very vastly different. And I'm not saying I'm not going to wait a value judgment here. It is what it is, but we want to look at it and kind of ask this question: Is this democratic?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, how can we make it so? So I want to kick it off to you. And I know with the Electoral College, everything that we know about it.
Yeah.
what are your thoughts?
So I think when we look at the Electoral College, again, we look into that topic of proportional representation. And I think the Electoral College by its design is more, it's trying to be a fair system to more rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
But that also can be very disproportional to rural areas by giving sometimes states that shouldn't have as big of sways, more sways in our elections. A lot of things we always hear about are swing states.
Mm-hmm.
For example, California is, I believe, the most populous state in the union.
It is, yes.
I always get that word New York, but yeah, it's definitely a major power in politics. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's a blue state. I think Reagan was the last Republican to win California. But it has an unbelievable amount of electoral votes. Was it 55?
55.
55, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's states like Vermont, which I believe have like two.
Three.
Three?
Yeah. So a state cannot have less than three.
Oh, yes. You can't have less than three. Yeah.
Because how they, just for context, how states are assigned electoral points, mm-hmm. is the number of congressional representation that they have, both in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So Washington, having 11, mm-hmm. has 9 representatives and 2 senators. Yeah. So they have 11 electoral points.
With that in mind, we hear a lot about states like Ohio, Florida, lately Wisconsin, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
States that sometimes lean more, we call them purple states.
Yeah.
But there's also a question that maybe these specific swing states have way more of a voice than maybe they should.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, Minnesota and Wisconsin were key in Biden winning the election, whereas Trump had won previously. By very narrow margins. But a lot of these states are winner takes all. Mm-hmm. Not all, but a majority of them are.
There's 2 states that split their electoral votes based on how you win the congressional districts.
Yeah, and I don't believe either of them are Minnesota or Wisconsin, if I'm...
No, it's New Hampshire and Nebraska.
Yeah. And typically those aren't the swing states.
No, nobody's really... Well, New Hampshire is a swing... New Hampshire has been in play in electoral math a bit. Nebraska, not at all, really.
Yeah. And so when we're looking at just the base value of how Democratic is it, you could look at it from a more macro view of just the states, mm-hmm. and say, should 3 or 4 states determine the outcome of an election? Because some of it, we all remember the Al Gore-Bush election in Florida, where mm-hmm. Gore basically lost the election but won the popular vote because the Electoral College in Florida boosted Bush. And I mean, there were a few more states, but he got a big boost from Florida.
It really came down to Florida.
Yeah. That gave Bush the election.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wonder, well, how can someone who loses the popular vote win the election? Mm-hmm. It's kind of it seems like an oxymoron.
At face value, it does. Yeah. Yes.
But that's also kind of, you can see there's a kind of a counterweight argument of, well, it gives smaller voices, the minorities, you know, the minority voices, mm-hmm. in rural areas or underrepresented areas, more of a chance than simply being dominated by the populace, mm-hmm. the masses of cities mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But that does seem in a way to be stifling, at least democracy on a populist basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to look into right now. I know there's been a lot of discussion in the House and the Senate, and a lot of voices just nationwide from, you know, celebrities and talk show hosts about getting rid of the Electoral College. Would that make the system more democratic? And that's something I'd like to ask you. Do you think, by its definition, the Electoral College is an undemocratic institution in our country when it comes to elections and democracy?
It's a good question, and I think you have to look at, so democracy, we're the United States is a democracy.
Yeah.
But democracy, I think, is the umbrella in which all of democracies fall under. Mm-hmm. It's a broad term, and it's kind of, if it's a government of the people, for the people, by the people, it's kind of like the baseline. Democracy is the baseline. And that's going to change based on the morals, values, expectations of the culture and society in which the governments are being formed.
Yeah.
That's why you have a lot of different democracies in the world and a lot of different styles in which those democratic governments are constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has a very weird relationship, I think, with federalism. Mm-hmm. And how do you go about making sure that such a large swath of land with so many diverse cultures, mm-hmm, is represented in a presidential system in which the executive branch and the legislative branch are co-equals, mm-hmm, and are elected under separate elections. Mm-hmm. Whereas a parliamentary system, you don't vote on the executive. The executive is elected amongst the peers of the party that is in the majority. Mm-hmm. So the presidential system being tied, being separate, how do you maintain this ethos of making sure that underrepresented ideas, policy preferences, values are represented and in the government when it seems that it is undemocratic at face value. Mm-hmm. You have the chief executive, which is we see as the most powerful position in the land, and in a way it is, mm-hmm, especially now with the preeminence of the executive branch in modern times. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that protection of those minority preferences, at face value, obviously, like I just said, it does seem democratic. But I think when you dig a little bit deeper, you actually see that it might be protecting of those voices in a way is actually democratic in spirit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, humans are fallible.
Yeah.
And I think the Electoral College has been used and manipulated in a way, especially through gerrymandering, to keep a particular party in power in really unfair ways.
Yeah. And to be fair, when it comes to these things, it's not simply one party or one group manipulating the prerequisites for the Electoral College to be abused.
Mm-hmm.
Blue and red both do it. This isn't simply a partisan issue.
Throughout history, yes, both parties have been guilty of it, for sure.
And it does affect outcomes. There's also a good question of, for example, California. People don't realize that there's a sizable Republican base in California, mm-hmm, but they're just absolutely swamped by a typically more Democrat, liberal, coast. Yep. I mean, the big cities, LA, San Diego, Sacramento, Oakland.
Mm-hmm. And that gets to one of the, so really quick before we take a break, I want to talk about, I think something you touched on there is the size and scope of states. This was an argument that was brought up to me when I was having this debate with somebody. And they said, well, the size of some of these states, mm-hmm, and the diverse populations within those states, and Electoral College being winner take all, and you brought that up, mm-hmm, when you were talking earlier, is that these are winner take all states. So whether all you have to do is win by one vote, mm-hmm, over your opponent, and you get all of that state's electoral votes.
Your state's blue, your state's red.
In some of those states, like you said, have such diverse population within them. You talk about the diversity of cultures and ideas and preferences and values across the nation as a whole. Mm-hmm. Even within each state, you've got a lot of that.
Yeah, Washington's a great example.
So maybe the answer is to figure out a way in which each you can keep the idea of the Electoral College alive, but you change it in a way that awards points to winners of congressional districts, right? Because think about it like this. So Nebraska and New Hampshire, I think, have touched on something.
Yeah.
How Nebraska and New Hampshire work is that you have two at-large electoral points.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually worth four. Actually, both those states are worth four. So you have two at-large electoral points. And then, actually, Nebraska's five. Sorry, I want to get there. So Nebraska, you at-large, if you win the state, so you win the popular vote in the state, you by however the margin is, you get the two allotted electoral votes that are there because of the senators.
Mm-hmm.
And then the winner of each congressional district then gets the electoral point assigned to that district.
Mm-hmm.
So if you win the Nebraska 3rd district, you get an electoral point. If you win the Nebraska 2nd, and so on.
Uh-huh.
So you could have like, you know, Trump won 4 of the 5 electoral points of Nebraska. He won the state at large, and he won 2 of the 3 congressional districts. Mm-hmm. But Biden pulled the more liberal third. So the people in that third district, which is like the Lincoln area, the mm-hmm. urban area in Nebraska, feels like they actually affected the election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like that. I feel like that in a way, I think that is a avenue in which we could explore to help the apathy. I think one of the issues we talk, I think it's brought up a lot too, is that if you're a red voter in Washington, you're a red voter in California, what's the point of even showing up and voting for president?
Yeah. And I think that is a huge thing, is voter apathy, and I think that also pushes people to the extremes. I think Texas is a good example of a state that's kind of purplish, mm-hmm. or becoming more purplish. But from, again, Texas is a winner take all state. What if it goes blue one year, a vast majority of the Texas, or at least a vast portion of the population in Texas, feels like they weren't represented.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's a big thing that we, as a nation, were one of our founding, you know, stories is a whole thing about, you know, no taxation without representation. Well, what about just our vote and our voice?
Yeah.
Let alone for taxes, just in general, when we're not being represented, because if by 1%, we lose an election, electoral or anything, mm-hmm. it's a winner take all. And yep. so that seems inherently undemocratic, because it gets rid of the red or blue voices in whichever state you're in.
Yeah, no, I think that's a phenomenal point. And I think we're going to take a break on that. When we get on the other side, I think we're going to tackle the equal representation in the Senate. We'll get into that. So thank you for listening to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
We'll be right back.
A big welcome and many thanks to KXRW's newest gold sponsor, Fusion CBD. Fusion CBD is a supplier of full-spectrum CBD. They offer CBD products to help you stay calm, balanced, and focused. All Fusion CBD products are derived from the whole plant that include gummies, tinctures, topicals, teas, mints, award-winning smokable flower, and pet products. Fusion CBD hemp is grown locally, and products range from 500 to 3,000 milligrams of total cannabinoids. To order products, visit FusionCBD.com or stop by the store on Highway 99 in Vancouver. Many thanks to our sponsor and friends at Say Chow Columbia River Tap Room and Eatery. Chef Peter has been cooking for over 27 years in the Vancouver area. Say Chow, Greater Vancouver's premier catering company. Conveniently located at 2501 Southeast Columbia Way in Vancouver. Dine in or take out for lunch Monday through Friday, 11 to 2 p.m. Hours will change and live local music will return once again as COVID phases allow. More information available at say-chow.com. That's say-chio.com, or directly at 360-210-5522.
Welcome back to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
In our last segment, we talked about the Electoral College and kind of talked about it in the context of, is it democratic or is it anti-democratic? And what ways in which can it be amended to be more democratic if it is in fact anti-democratic? And we talked about some of the historical context around the Electoral College. And I think we're going to continue this debate with something else that is a mechanism of giving minority power to parties that are not in the majority. And that is with equal representation in the U.S. Senate. First off, where does equal representation come from and what does it mean?
Yeah. So I know we mentioned earlier the Virginia Compromise.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the big catalyst to it in the United States. As you mentioned, it's kind of the whole debate between big states wanting to make sure that they were, you know, properly represented, but also minorities, states, smaller states, concerns of just being, you know, ran out of town every election because they couldn't compete.
Mm-hmm.
I know you mentioned also earlier how the U.S., for example, has a bicameral
Legislature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, legislature. So we have a House and a Senate.
Yep.
Or the upper and lower, I think. Or is that more, I guess upper and lower isn't really as.
Well, they're equal,
yeah.
But their makeup is different.
Yeah.
And then there's a bit of difference in how, like, so bills have to originate in the House,
yeah.
and then they have to pass, but they have to pass both chambers, and there's a lot of different rules with all of that. But
yeah.
well, that's not what we're talking. Yeah. We're not talking about the Senate. We're gonna go, but no, I mean, it's all good context, though.
Yeah, so. but really, the big thing is that the Senate was for the. Mainly the protection of the smaller states. Every state gets two.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter if you have a population of 300 million or 100,000. Every state gets two senators.
Yeah.
The House is a more proportional representation with amongst the states. So bigger populations get more representatives than smaller populations. Mm-hmm. So, for example, California has, you know, how many representatives do they have now?
They would be 53 total. Yeah,
53. And then smaller states like... I don't know, Rhode Island have, I think, three?
Rhode Island would have, only one representative.
Two senators, yeah. Sorry, to be specific, we were saying 53, like, House of Representatives mm-hmm. members. Rhode Island have two.
Yeah.
One, mm-hmm. two senators. And then, so Rhode Island wouldn't have the same pull in the House as, obviously, California.
Sure.
So it's much more proportional. So there's that kind of equal balance that, mm-hmm. that came out of the Virginia Compromise, which is, you know, the whole basis for our system.
Yeah. In an era where, you know, think about the historical context of the time, the states were much more, the idea of being part of a state and being the statehood being your identity, I think was a lot different than it is today, right?
Yeah.
Because you got these colonists who are coming out of, one, the American Revolution, mm-hmm. where being a New Yorker, you were a New Yorker first before you were an American.
Yeah.
And then under the Articles of Confederation, which put the states in a supremacy position over the federal government.
Yeah.
And it was more of a confederation of states. So you were very much a citizen of New York before you were an American. And then you got this constitution that flips that a bit, but you're still, you grew up, you were socialized into that system where you see yourself as a member of the state. So your thought of, well, my state needs to have more representation made sense for the time and what, and what the thoughts and fears were of government,
yeah.
right? If you were someone living in Rhode Island at that time,
yeah.
now it seems a bit like, well, yeah, you're from Rhode Island, but you're an American, right?
Yeah.
First, so I think it's just a very different way of it's just me kind of spitballing, but just I think it's just a little bit different way of kind of trying to look at what was the ideas behind this weird kind of differences in the two different houses of our Congress. So I want to read something here that I came across in my research on what are the different ways in which the equal representation, like, why is it, is it basically following, I guess, along this line of what we've been talking about in this episode, is it democratic?
Yeah.
And when you think about someone in Wyoming, for mm-hmm. example, this article here, the path to giving California 12 senators and Vermont just one. It was an article in the Atlantic written by Eric W. Otis. And he brings up some good points. I don't agree with everything, but anyway, he does point out that the situation with the Senate is becoming increasingly untenable.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in Wyoming has 60, their voting power because of having two senators in their population doesn't even actually warrant having one representative
mm-hmm.
because they have such a small population in terms of the congressional districts
mm-hmm.
In other states. Like, they don't even have enough population to warrant one congressional district in Wyoming.
Yeah.
That's how sparsely populated that state is. So the average voter today in 2020 in 2020 had 67 times more weighted than someone in California.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem particularly fair.
It doesn't seem particularly democratic.
No, it doesn't. And so what on earth can be done? Because the Electoral College isn't in the Constitution.
Yeah.
It can be changed with the passing of a bill.
Yeah.
The Senate, the equal representation of the Senate is enshrined in Article, and it is enshrined that in Article 5, it specifically states that one state, two senators.
Yeah.
So without an amendment process,
It's virtually impossible.
It's virtually impossible because even then it says because even the wording of Article 5 talks about the equal suffrage of states, equal representation of states, as being something that just, it's like, it is, cannot be changed. The wording of that is very clear in the Constitution. Yeah. But this article makes a case for it, saying that through the Voting Rights Acts you actually can make an argument that it can be. And we don't need to really get into that, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on equal representation and what are its pitfalls, forgetting about the constitutionality of it, how would you like to see it maybe changed?
Well, I think one of the biggest pitfalls is kind of something we did see with the electoral colleges. If you had proportional representatives within the Senate, so mm-hmm. again, hypothetical example, California gets 12, Vermont gets 1.
Mm-hmm.
You have these states that would essentially, the biggest states would run the show in Congress. Wyoming would never have a chance if it was truly proportional.
Mm-hmm.
To get their voice truly heard. I mean, you could argue that could make coalitions with other, you know, red or blue states, depending on what side
sure,
they lean.
Sure, yeah.
But even then, are you telling me that a coalition of, you know, southern states could compete against the powerhouses of California, New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, you know, these big blue states? I find it unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it kind of passes the buck.
Sure.
It replaces the Electoral College with a kind of pseudo Electoral College in a way.
But for the Senate
yeah. and for that. Because it still would be, again, more of a winner's take all kind of mm-hmm. deal.
Sure.
And I'm sure, again, it depends on how those senators are split up within each state. So that if all 12 are in blue counties, it's going to mean nothing for the red districts in their state. I'm sure mm-hmm. there has to be some type of way to make it so that it's still more proportional within the state itself for how the senators are split up.
Yeah. So I think you touched perfectly into the part I want to talk about, and that's his framework mm-hmm. for reworking the Senate. And I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So he said one of the important things about the equal representation that needs to be kept is this real idea of federalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the federal government does preside over the states. Mm-hmm. So having a true proportional representation, making basically a redundancy. If you completely did away with equal representation in the Senate, there'd be no point of even having a Senate. You might as well just abolish it and have a one house legislature. Mm-hmm. So what he argues is that each state only gets one. Every state gets one senator. And then from there, you use the rules of 100.
Uh-huh.
So you start with 100 pieces, and each state, according with this author's argument, is that each state gets a senator based on their proportion of that population up to 100.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have 20% of the, if you have 2% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
of the United States, you get two senators.
Yeah.
And so forth. And how he ended up working that out is that there are a lot of states that end up only getting one. While other states like California, based on their population, they end up getting 12.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that basically does is it helps give more senators to states where there is a very diverse population. We talked about this in the Electoral College segment, last segment, that there are so many different we're talking about California, right? Mm-hmm. There's only two senators for that state, and they're generally only blue because they're at large seats for the entire state. You add six to that, maybe that does open up the door for having some Republican senators coming out of California,
mm-hmm.
And some blue. So maybe you have better representation of the population as a whole than you would with only two Senate seats.
Yeah.
Theoretically, you could see that happening. Yeah.
And it could also pave the way for coalitions, like you see in more European models,
mm-hmm.
More red states have to kind of band together, or maybe even more moderates band together within blue and red.
Yeah.
It's definitely an interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
How likely that could ever be put into practice based on the system we have is kind of difficult to say. Again, amendments are very difficult to pass,
mm-hmm.
as we are well aware. But it's definitely something that I think wouldn't you could make the argument that it would bolster the strength of the democracy of the institutions that we have because they would be more proportionally representative to its constituents.
Mm-hmm.
I think what people are starting to feel, you mentioned this off air, but there's a lot of apathy towards the process because they don't feel like their voice is being heard.
Sure.
Again, like you mentioned earlier, people in, you know, Yakima, do they feel like they're represented by the city or by the state of Washington because it's mainly dominated by Seattle? I mean, mm-hmm. King County runs Washington. Like, let's be honest.
Yep.
Like, the western part of the state runs most affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think they really feel like there's a real good reason to vote? No, if anything, it weakens the democratic norms we have of going out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, my vote doesn't matter.
Sure.
You could also see the same thing in the opposite argument, though, of saying that, well, if you live in a very blue state and you're a Democrat, you don't really have to vote because people are going to vote for you.
Mm-hmm.
If there was more at stake when it comes to proportional representation, where your vote would make more of a difference, if there was a better divide of the senators and how they're divided, that may make more of a cause for people to vote.
Sure.
I don't know if that would be entirely the case. If you compare it to more European models, I'm not convinced that it is. You could look at, for example, France had pretty historically low turnouts recently for some of their elections. Mm-hmm. Not in all areas, but in a lot of provinces and states around the Republic, it was pretty low. But at least people, I think, have more of a proportional choice. At least, again, France is a little bit different than some proportional democracies like the UK or Sweden or other or Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But I think looking at the American model specifically, you just don't have that option. You don't have an option to vote for, you know, I guess more than two options. You get Democrat, Republican.
Mm-hmm.
There is no viable third party in America, and there's no way to have that person be represented in our system, mm-hmm. which may be more viable in a system where we split up the senators based on the area. You could see a viable Green candidate or a Libertarian or you know, any party, but I just don't find it in the system we have now and the confines of it. It's very much you're red or blue, and it's winner take all.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that just seems inherently undemocratic.
Yeah. It's an easy system to get.
It's a simple system.
It is simple. And there is something to say about simplicity in elections. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you followed the New York mayoral race at all. In their attempt to use ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice, yeah.
And I am a proponent of ranked choice, mm-hmm. but it is very convoluted.
It is.
And it takes a very wonky political person like myself to get excited about it and to even mm-hmm. try to go about trying to understand it.
Yeah.
And think about our last election, if there had to be multiple rounds of ranked choice voting.
It'd get messy.
It would get very messy. Mm-hmm. And then how those votes are how the losers' votes are then allocated, right? There's a lot to be worked out there. So that majoritarian system, you're right, creates for this very polarized red versus blue system. And it's unfortunate that minority parties, which I think could potentially represent individuals in areas better. Mm-hmm. That's why the Scottish Nationalist yeah. Party has seats in British Parliament.
Yeah.
And the SNP or some of the other minority parties do have seats in Parliament in Britain, in England. So you would like, I think it would be nice to see that in the United States, but it is difficult.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said about simplicity.
Yeah.
Even though it has trade-offs. I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
But back to the equal representation, I think that there is something to be said on a racial component. And I think that when you have states like Wyoming and you're talking about the ability, because I'm thinking about the passage or the failing to pass voter rights mm-hmm. legislation and trying to make it easier for people who are historically disenfranchised to be able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And not failing in the Senate, I think, was a failure of it was a failure for America
mm-hmm.
that legislation didn't pass.
Yeah.
And that didn't pass because of the equal representation and the roadblocks in the Senate.
Yeah.
You have states like Wyoming that are 86% white.
Mm-hmm.
are putting out two senators mm-hmm. that are not, that basically, if you look at the makeup of the Senate, is enough to block stuff like that.
Yeah.
They don't even have the population to warrant those that kind of representation, and they're putting forth people that are limiting the voices to be heard in other states.
Yeah, like Georgia.
In perfect example, right? Mm-hmm. States that have, where whites are barely the majority mm-hmm. or aren't the majority.
Yeah.
Have high, really high populations of people of color mm-hmm. and other minority populations, mm-hmm. and their voices are being railroaded mm-hmm. because of this proportional representation yeah. in the Senate.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at the wording of Article 5, there is this art. I think this author rightfully points it out that one of the key words in Article 5 is that the voters. The people's right to vote shall not be abridged. Mm-hmm. Close quote. It's not exact. I'm trying to paraphrase. But basically, what the definition of abridged is limited being limited in any way. And I think when you talk about the grand scope of things, this equal representation and how unproportionate it is, mm-hmm. is limiting and cheapening certain people's votes.
Absolutely.
And I think that there should be normative language, but I do think that in the much more black and white, I think, than the electoral colleges, I think this equal representation issue in the Senate needs to be, I think, for democracy's sake, needs to be addressed in some way.
Yeah.
So that's just that's my take on it. So, I think we're kind of up against a break, so I think we'll leave it there. I think we made some really good points, though, and I hope that this helped you guys kind of understand this idea of equal representation and its pitfalls and some of its and you know, it does have there, it is rooted in history of having a purpose, but maybe that purpose is outlasted its welcome. Up for you to decide, but we're just having the debate. So when we come back, I think we're going to talk about the Senate filibuster, and we'll wrap up the episode. So you've been listening to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
We'll be right back.
Community Radio Like This is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at adco1.com. That's ADCO, the number one.com.
Baseball is back. The Richfield Raptors 2021 season starts June 2nd at the Richfield Outdoor Recreation Complex in Richfield, Washington. The Raptors are Southwest Washington's exceptional West Coast League baseball team. Come on out for some affordable, family-friendly entertainment and enjoy the sights and sounds of hometown team baseball at its best. Head to RichfieldRaptors.com for schedule and ticket information.
Welcome back to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
In our last segment, we talked about the equal representation in the Senate and whether that is Democratic or it's anti-democratic in nature, and how shifting politics and population density is really playing into a lot of underrepresentation for people of color and overrepresenting states that have primarily white populations. But for now, I think we're going to move on to talking about the Senate filibuster. Mm-hmm. Matt, what is the Senate filibuster?
Well, the filibuster is not the sequel to blockbusters, unfortunately.
That's unfortunate. I miss video stores.
So the filibuster is basically, in layman's terms, in order to get any bill passed beyond just like budgetary, mm-hmm. you need a 60 vote threshold to pass a bill in Congress.
Okay.
If you do not have that, it's not ideal.
Yeah.
Basically, nothing gets done.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been talks in the media, in the world, in space, of ending the filibuster.
Yes.
So that if you have a simple majority, so 51 votes,
mm-hmm.
you can pass anything.
Yeah.
Budgetary, military, anything.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I know you mentioned off air, one key point that I think is one we should bring up is it will make things pass mm-hmm. more.
Yes.
Things will pass.
Yeah.
The problem is it may not be things you like.
Mm-hmm.
From any party. If the liberals have a or the Democrats have a simple 51 seat majority, they can pass anything without Republican input. If the Republicans hold the seats, they can pass anything without the input of Democratic colleagues. So bipartisanship is essentially gone. There's no need for bipartisanship. You just need a majority. I guess the only way this could get kind of weird is if there wasn't a majority for some reason, which I don't, like, I don't see that happening. I mean, like, for example, it's a two-party system. Someone's going to have the majority.
But say, you know, Bernie Sanders is still an independent, and there are ways if somehow a third party, which with a majoritarian system and first past the post voting, it's very unlikely that there's a third party has any sort of seats.
On paper, possible, but virtually it's.
But if there's a 50-50 split, then the vice president,
then
is the deciding vote,
and that could, again, depending on who, what color has the office, so red or blue affects
but
which way it goes.
But devil's advocate, that's the assumption that all party members are going to vote in lockstep. And as we have seen with a man named Joe Manchin
or Kyrsten Sinema
from Arizona, that isn't always the case.
And that's where things also get messy. The only thing is, I know we mentioned this off air too, Is this simply removing a weapon to add a new weapon? In my eyes, you remove the weapon of the filibuster with the majority, having a 60-seat majority to vote to pass a bill in order to have basically when you're in power, you call the shots. It would definitely probably break up the gridlock, but I mean, is your voice heard? So if there's a blue majority, a red majority, is your voice heard if you're the minority party? Because basically, as long as the people are in line, the party's in line, Democrat or Republican, again, let's just say for right now, let's just say the Democrats have their 51 seat or they have 51 seats. They don't need the vice president. They have 51 seats right now and they're in control.
Sure.
Why would they listen to the Republicans? They have no incentive to.
No.
The reason that the filibuster at least gives an incentive is that there can be some level of bipartisanship so that in the future there may be more negotiations so that they can get 60 seats or 60 votes for a particular legislation. It might make more bipartisanship, but it slows things down. So it's a hard thing to argue for or against because, frankly, it's unknown. The only thing is I would caution is we get rid of the filibuster, let's just say in this hypothetical America we live in, and let's just say the Democrats lose in the midterm elections and the Republicans take over.
Which is likely.
What is the recourse for the Republicans to be bipartisan with the Democrats? There is none.
No, I mean, it'll be tit for tat politics.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, which I don't think will do the nation necessarily good in the long run, but it may see that people are like, well, Congress is passing things, this is what they're supposed to do, and maybe that's a fair argument. They're supposed to pass bills.
The numbers back that up. I think Congress has a 12% approval rating nationally, and I'm surprised they even have 12%.
It's not ideal, but just because they can pass more bills, one doesn't mean that they're passing good bills. It simply means they're passing bills. For example, we're seeing it right now with the infrastructure bill. Though, I mean, theoretically, it could be passed with budget reconciliation. They don't really have to. I mean, because again, it's a budgetary bill.
Yeah, but there's a limitation on how many times you can use budget reconciliation in the Senate rules.
Yeah,
and I'm a little confused on. They might have to wait until October until they can.
I believe you're right.
Because it's a certain fiscal year that they can use certain types of budget reconciliation. I don't think they can do it until October.
Yeah. So I just meant in theory, I guess maybe we should clarify that. In theory, they could have done it on the infrastructure bill.
The most recent one that's being.
Yeah. If they hadn't used it previously.
Yeah. But they used it previously for the Save America
Plan.
Act. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
And so, unfortunately. Now it leads into the world of bipartisanship, which is sad to say that it's unfortunate. We should always strive for bipartisanship. But in practice, it's not happening.
No. I mean, I think in a perfect world, right, I think so much of our Constitution is written in normative language.
Yeah.
And so much of the early documents that were written about the Constitution and how politics should be done in a very courtly manner. And I think that so much of it is like that the founders never really envisioned that people would act in such a way. I mean, you are a white landowning male of stature. You do things in a certain way. I'm saying that in jest, but it's so much of it's written in normative language, right? So the until someone just decides, I don't have to do it like that. Like, what's the and Trump was famous for this. Like, what do you mean? It's just there's not an actual law. I can just do it if I just decide to do it. Mm-hmm. And so much of how the Senate governs itself and the Senate operates is off of precedence, just the way things have been done. The Constitution is not a very wordy document. It's actually pretty short.
Yeah.
And considering how much it sets up, which means that a lot of the day-to-day operation stuff is stuff that is codified over time.
Yeah.
And so my point about the filibuster is that in a perfect world, you've got 100 people sitting in this in the Senate chamber who are altruistic and they want to do what's best for the country first. Yes, they have their differences and they have allegiances to their party, but they're looking to try to come to bipartisan agreements, and compromise is not seen as weakness. Unfortunately, with the polarization of our politics, is that compromise is seen as weakness in a lot of ways. And the people who are being elected to Congress right now are going there on a mandate to not be cooperative.
Yeah.
They're being
all or nothing.
They're being elected to go and stop the Democrats, or they're being elected to go and stop the Republicans, not to go to DC to work things out with other elected officials.
Yeah.
This very norm of representation, the very underlying idea of a republic, which is the type of democracy that we are, is completely undermined by politicization. In the Senate, something like the Senate filibuster, which in normative thinking makes sense, that to force bipartisanship, to make sure bipartisanship is happening, now it's just being used as a weapon by a minority party that represents an increasingly fewer amount of people than this more populated states, holding up legislation that is by far and away supported by a clear majority of Americans nationwide. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure bill is incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. And yet they can't even get enough votes to pass. They can't even get enough votes to pass it on a 51 vote.
Yeah.
Majority as it stands right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what you were saying, is that if we get rid of it now, who's to say what is going to happen? The slippery slope argument, right? Mm-hmm. And as like kind of a more naturally conservative person like myself, I tend to maybe overvalue slippery slope arguments. But I think in this case, when you turn over, you eliminate this mechanism. And to put in context, it is not part of the Constitution, like the equal representation in the Senate is, and it's not as structured as the Electoral College. It is something that the Senate can basically change its own rules to do.
Yeah.
Does the Senate going that direction undermine the very nature of bipartisanship by eliminating the filibuster?
Yeah, and to me, the answer goes probably, because again, what is the incentive for bipartisanship? There isn't. Flat out, you just need a simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Congress is operating based on past behavior, I don't see a viable reason for there to be bipartisan compromise.
Sure.
Because you can look at, for example, some of the extremes of the ends. AOC, Marjorie Taylor Greene, some of the more boisterous and again more extreme sides of both parties. They are very, I would say AOC probably has had more history of bipartisanship than Marjorie Taylor Greene. But if you have people going in there with the mindset of no compromise, I'm going to push my bills and my agendas through party lines, which seems to be what kind of most of Congress is doing. There is no reason to compromise. And that changes everything. I mean, you could have a Democratic a Democrat president or a Republican president whose legislative branch with a simple majority is basically completely running an opposite agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And there lacks coherency in policy.
Yeah.
That could be a huge problem.
I think that's a really good point that you brought up there in how the legislative branch, the Senate specifically, without the filibuster, interacts with the executive branch.
Yeah.
And I think the concern there also would be then is the Senate just becoming a rubber stamp if they share the same party as the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
They just become a rubber stamp for the president's agenda.
They become a stonewall.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think you and I have kind of come on an agreement, and feel free, the listeners, to disagree with us. I mean, I'm totally open to the idea of removing the filibuster. I just have concerns about it. So I think just for conversation's sake, to move this thing forward a little bit, let's just say we're not going to remove the filibuster. How can the filibuster then be changed to make it more tenable for today's politics?
So when it comes to the efficacy of what would be the best option given the current political climate, I think it's a more fair argument. I could see the on paper why it would make sense to end the filibuster.
Sure.
Simply because people are voting purely on party lines for the majority of legislation going past through mm-hmm. the Senate. If we had a more proportional system, like we've mentioned, one where, say, the way senators were broken up in states were different, so that red and blue were reflected more proportionally.
Sure.
The filibuster may make more sense.
Yeah.
Because it keeps things bipartisan.
I see where you're going with this. I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
I think right now, I don't think keeping the filibuster makes sense purely for a legislative standpoint because it's just causing more gridlock.
Okay.
Again, I'm not saying that it'll be a necessarily wholly good thing. Yeah. Again, you may get some legislation passed with a simple majority that is, I think the technical term is hot garbage. It could cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, definitely the scientific term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is you just don't know. And that can go for either side.
Yeah.
The Democrats could pass something that's absolutely ludicrous. The Republicans could pass something that's absolutely ludicrous with a simple majority if we get rid of the filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is right now, they could still be passing some things that are pretty ludicrous with bipartisanship, or they're passing nothing. They're passing watered down bills that really don't have the reach and scope that they could if they were passed with more gumption. But then again, mm-hmm. again, it's a real back and forth.
It is.
It's a real back and forth of, do we pass higher quality bills with bipartisanship or do we not? I mean, looking at this infrastructure bill, I mean, it's completely watered down from what Joe Biden originally had hoped for and mm-hmm. for what Democrats had hoped for. But does that mean it's less effective? It's hard to say because it hasn't been implemented. We have some ideas of where it'll go, but if we had a simple, you know, a filibuster-free Senate, could we have passed a much more robust infrastructure bill that could be much more far-reaching in scope and depth?
I think the answer to that specific question is yes, because if you look at the differences between what the Democrats view as a whole encompassing infrastructure, which is both human and physical infrastructure, and I'm not going to get into that, but
yeah.
Biden has tried to define it. And the Republicans, even moderate Republicans like Mitt Romney, very much with their rhetoric about the bill saying physical infrastructure only, you would have very, very, very different bills
yeah.
passed. So I think it depends on where you fall in the political spectrum.
Yeah.
So with that particular thing, but that's the frustrating thing, right? Is that there's things that we know need to be passed.
Yeah.
And there's things that absolutely like they're incredibly maddening when you hear certain senators giving absolute BS answers for why they didn't vote for something. Mm-hmm. Especially when you know they supported infrastructure when the last president, the president of their party, was in power and now are fighting a tooth and nail.
Yeah.
That is not in the Democratic spirit. That is not in the spirit of Republicanism. I'm not talking Republicanism in terms of the party, but a republic. That undermines the very when the filibuster became a thing, or when the equal representation was being thought of, it was being thought of, like I said, in normative language. And norms are out the window.
Yeah.
This is real politic. This is what can we do to enhance our own party's power?
Yeah.
And the filibuster works in a perfect world. And right now, it just seems like it is, as much as I worry about slippery slopes, this filibuster, once again, is just another mechanism that is being used to really disproportionately benefit one particular side, and that is the side that is not even, it is increasingly becoming less of the, even becoming smaller of a minority within the political world of the United States.
Yeah.
So that is really problematic. So we don't really have the answers, but I hope that this conversation, I think, helps kind of propel forward in the listeners' minds these three very important institutional processes and mechanisms that are in place that might need to be changed to preserve our republic.
Yeah.
And I think it's a conversation that we all need to have. So, Matt, thanks again for being on. I really appreciate it, you coming back. Would love to get you on next month.
Yeah.
So, you guys have been listening to The Republic. I am Jake.
And I'm Matt.
We will be back next month.
Big thank you to Craft Cannabis, formerly known as New Vansterdam, for supporting our radio community. Craft Cannabis now has two locations here in Vancouver. Both locations offer online ordering and curbside pickup. The Mill Plain location has an express window that serves as a contactless option to pick up your cannabis products. The newest shop is located on Andreessen Road, off Patton Parkway, next to the Home Depot, across from Costco. Both locations are open daily, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. More information available at craftcannabis.com. KXRW Vancouver Radio is a volunteer-powered and community-supported 501c3 nonprofit organization. As for so many nonprofits, COVID-19 has understandably thrown a huge wrench in our usual live fundraising event efforts, and why your support right now would be so helpful. If you like our purpose-driven, informative, local talk and music programming that gives Vancouver a voice and want to help us make more, please consider becoming a KXRW monthly member today. New KXRW merch is in as a fun perk when you sign up. We have two new cool KXRW t-shirt designs to choose from. Here are the following levels of giving. $15 monthly, receive a t-shirt of your choice. $25 monthly, receive one KXRW t-shirt, mug, and tote bag. $50 a month, receive two KXRW t-shirts, two mugs, and two tote bags, plus four tickets to the next KXRW backstage block party. One-time donations are always welcome as well. Every little bit helps us with our monthly operational costs and expanding equipment needs. After all, an informed community is a healthier community, so let's all be a part of the solution and please become a KXRW monthly member today. Go to www.kxrw.fm and click on our merch page for details. Thank you.